You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the holiday 2019-2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Vanishing by Nathaniel Rich. Far more likely is the narrative of Jerry the Royal F-Up. In this version of the story, scams beget scams and incompetence snowballs into recklessness and squander. The public bid was a last-ditch effort to salvage a flailing Ponzi, exploiting positive press and public sympathy to bilk money from investors. We now know that Cotton began no later than 2015 to steal his clients' funds. He also created dozens of false trading accounts to stimulate trading volume on the platform, a fact he even disclosed in the 2015 filings. He neglected to disclose, however, that he filled those fake accounts with invented funds, trading counterfeit Bitcoin for real Bitcoin and Canadian and American dollars. By the time of his death, Cotton's sham trading accounts, which had names like R2D2 and C3PO, had conducted approximately 300,000 trades. After the public bid failed, he kept no internal records, an almost inconceivable state of affairs for a company with an annual trading volume of more than $1 billion. In Ernst & Young's phrase, one imagines its battalion of stern accountants in various shades of apoplexy, typical segregation of duties and basic internal controls did not appear to exist. Most years, Cotton neglected to file a personal tax return. When he did file, he claimed no income from Quadriga. Cotton provided withdrawals manually, seeming to give preference to the customers who complained loudest in public forums. He sent cash in paper bags and shoeboxes to coffee shops, laundromats, and pool halls. He also accepted cash deposits. A year before his death, he sent a colleague a photograph taken in the kitchen of his Kelowna home. On the polished granite island are a vase of pink roses, the discarded lid of an ice cream carton, a copy of National Geographic, and dozens of dictionary-thick, rubber-banded stacks of Canadian currency in crisp 20s, 50s, and hundreds. Still, Cotton was not directly responsible for all of his troubles. Because Canadian banks refused to accept cryptocurrency businesses as clients, Quadriga had to rely on third-party processors, which levied outrageous fees and in some cases stole funds outright. One Quadriga contractor claims today that the payment processor WB21, now the subject of federal lawsuits in the United States, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom, stole $14 million, and that another processor stole $5.8 million. Patron Jennifer Robertson and at least a couple of other Quadriga contractors each operated their own payment processing firms, a significant conflict of interest, though not illegal. There was also the $21 million Canadian dollars seized by CIBC and the software glitch, which cost Quadriga $14 million Canadian dollars overnight. Despite all this, Quadriga should have had about $200 million Canadian dollars of its customers' funds in its cold wallets, the external hard drives disconnected from the Internet that functioned like bank vaults. But within a month after Cotton's reported death, blockchain investigators proved that nearly all of the inaccessible wallets were empty. Cotton, it turned out, had transferred the funds into personal accounts on competitor exchanges. At least some of those accounts had also been emptied. The operator of an exchange on which Cotton opened accounts told Ernst & Young that Cotton had squandered most of his holdings on reckless trades. On one particular margin account, he conducted 67,000 individual trades alone, placing enormous bets on fledgling currencies like Dogecoin, Omisco, and Zcash. In 2014, Cotton spoke publicly of moving currencies between exchanges to take advantage of arbitrage opportunities. It may be that he traded Quadriga's funds in a frantic effort to recoup the losses he had sustained. It was the behavior of a doomed gambler employing the martingale strategy, successively doubling down in a desperate effort to get back to zero until he had dug a hole so deep that he could only be buried inside it. After he squandered what remained in Quadriga's coffers, the price of Bitcoin plunged, and there was a run on the exchange. Then he flew to India, where things managed to get even worse. The honeymoon. There is yet another possibility, one that none of the case's investigators is willing to discount. Call it the mastermind theory. It begins with a few findings that do not fit neatly into the Royal F-Up narrative. Cotton had mentioned having a safe bolted to the rafters in the attic of his home, in which he had stored the passwords to his various cryptocurrency accounts. After learning of his death, one of his contractors immediately went to the house and searched for it. He found the place in the attic where four holes had been drilled through the rafters, but the safe was gone. Eric Schletz, the pilot who brokered Cotton's purchase of the Cessna 400, has described having seen Cotton walking through an airport with $50,000 in cash. There were rumors of other employees taking similar trips. Perhaps Cotton's obsessive foreign travel, he boasted of having visited more than 50 countries without ever having been searched by customs, was inspired not by wanderlust, but by strategy. In this way, Cotton could have stowed away a fortune in foreign bank accounts in preparation for a grand exit. What if the furious trading on other exchanges near the end of his life was not careless, but calculated? This is a question that the lead investigator for the FBI's cybercrime division, Jennifer Vanderveer, has posed to crypto experts. It is theoretically possible to conduct high-volume trades in such a way as to launder funds, provided that the trades are exotic enough to ensure that the losses accrue to another account that Cotton or an associate controls. Cotton's trades were so bizarre and so risky that this seemed plausible, just as plausible, perhaps, as the idea that Cotton believed a series of Hail Mary bets on Zcash would come through. The RCMP and the FBI have refused to comment, but some of their interview subjects have gotten the impression that they believe Cotton might not be dead. "They asked me about 20 times if he was alive," says one witness who has intimate knowledge of Quadriga's workings and has been questioned by both agencies. "They always end our conversations with that question." QCXINT, the creditor and blockchain expert, said that the FBI's Vanderveer told him that with hundreds of millions of dollars missing and no body, it's an open question. The only way to verify that the body Robertson brought home from India was Cotton is to exhume it. The RCMP, which has jurisdiction over the case, has thus far not done so. For his part, Patron says he hasn't seen any reason to think that Cotton is alive. Under the mastermind theory, Cotton ran Quadriga much as he had S&S Investments and its successors, honoring enough withdrawal requests to maintain credibility. The plan, from the beginning, would be to keep the con going as long as possible before vanishing with the money. After Bitcoin collapsed, and the withdrawal complaints turned into lawsuits, negative press, and the threat of a formal investigation, Cotton got married, wrote a will, flew to India for his honeymoon, and disappeared. If the mastermind theory seems far-fetched, it's worth pointing out that an exit scam can only succeed if it seems far-fetched. Cotton built his career on the insight that most people are willing to believe most of what they are told most of the time. Jerry the mastermind would count on the world believing he was reckless, greedy, and dead. He would count on most people to forget all about him. Most people, a year after his death, already have. In October, Robertson signed a settlement in the Quadriga bankruptcy case, agreeing to forfeit approximately $12 million Canadian dollars of assets to the creditor class. In a statement released by her lawyer, she said she had no knowledge of Cotton's improper business practices and was upset and disappointed when she learned of them through the investigation. She expressed a desire to move on with the next chapter of my life. She may have time to change her name one more time in order to do so. If Jerry the mastermind is alive, what is he doing? He would have new names and passports, perhaps a new face. He might still be collaborating with Patron, or Patron might be trying to track him down in a final act of con versus con. Cotton may be hoping Robertson will join him once all the investigations have concluded, or she may be just another one of his victims. He might be living on a private island, or in Hong Kong, Thailand, or Monaco, traveling by yacht and helicopter and private jet. He might even be eating cheeseburgers and drinking beer. Jerry the mastermind might think he will get away with it, and he will, as long as everyone else believes he hasn't. Now here's a Vanity Fair Spotlight by Michael Schneerson. After this musical break. Now, this Vanity Fair Spotlight by Michael Schneerson, Keeping Pace, with photographs by Art Stryver. Gathering Beneath Enormous Glass Chandeliers by Fred Wilson, R. James Sienna, Kevin Francis Gray, Zhang Zhougang, Mary Corse, Nina Kachaturian, Fred Wilson, Kohai Nawa, Linda Binglis, Wang Guangle, Leo Villarreal, Hong Hao, Michael Rovner, and Q. Xiaofei. Ariana Shashe, Liu Jinhua, Emilia Kabakov, Julian Schnabel, Tim Eitel, Kiki Smith, Loi Hollowell, Li Ufan, Li Songsong, William Monk, Song Dong, and Yin Yuzhen. Lorna K. Gordon, Yu Minyun, Ralph Nauta, Lucas Samaras, Joel Shapiro, Kleis Oldenburg, Robert Whitman, Sui Jung Lau, Richard Tuttle, Maya Lin, Brent Wadden, and Richard Lloyd. Nigel Cook, Keith Saunier, Chuck Close, Zhao Yu, Keith Coventry, Adam Pendleton, Rakib Shaw, Paul Graham, Hao Bo, Tara Donovan, Adrian Jenny, Tim Hawkinson, and Robert Mangold. Keeping Pace. For the September opening of Manhattan's massive new Pace Gallery, 8 floors of soaring ambition on Chelsea's West 25th Street, 50 of its artists from across half a century shown in these photos in the building's 7th floor gallery gathered to honor Pace's founding family, Arne and Millie Glimcher, and their son, Mark, the gallery's president and CEO. Arne was all of 25 in 1963 when he'd moved with Millie from Boston to New York City to open a modest space on 57th Street. They were late to the game. Pop art had popped. So they made do with a random roster of talent and let instinct guide them. One after another, their artist, Louise Nevelson, Jean Dubuffet, Agnes Martin, Chuck Close, Robert Irwin, and more, pushed Pace to greatness. It was Mark, re-entering the fold after the occasional father-son rift, who made the case for a vertical tower to house Pace's 2 New York galleries, and perhaps get the jump on the contemporary art market's 3 other mega dealers. So it's come to pass. David Zwirner is racing to finish his own Chelsea Tower. So is Hauser and Wirth. As for Larry Gagosian, he snapped up 2 more locations nearby, Pace's just-vacated space and Mary Boone's, after tax issues led her to shut down, to swell his global kingdom to nearly 20 dominions. For the moment, though, Pace has bragging rights to the world's biggest single contemporary art gallery. The new showpiece by Bonetti-Kozerski Architecture is a huge risk, not least because the Glimchers don't own the building. Even after kicking in a reported $18.2 million to help build it, they merely have a 20-year lease at $8.45 million a year. But on opening night, the place pumped with passion. All the gallery's luminaries were on hand, including Maya Lin, Kleis Oldenburg, Lucas Samaras, Julian Schnabel, Kiki Smith, and Richard Tuttle. Sending their regrets were Robert Irwin, James Turrell, and David Hockney, who was in the midst of such a creative spurt, churning out dozens of new works at his retreat in Normandy, that he insisted on staying home to stay in the groove. Up on the gallery's vast open-air terrace, right on time and with spirit to spare, The Who's Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend serenaded the A-list art crowd, ripping into The Kids Are All Right. Daltrey's tribute was telling. "Thank you, Mark Glimcher," he cried, "and all hopes for your great success." The new Pace was the next generation's gamble. The sons as bold as his dad's. Passion Play. Co-stars and co-parents Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale are putting a verite twist on a new version of Medea by Keziah Weir. Photographs by Sharif Hamza, styled by Beth Fenton. Opening photo, True Romance. Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale photographed in Brooklyn. The only thing more compulsively mesmerizing than one famous person is two famous people in love. The cultural fascination with celebrity couples isn't complicated. They are our own relationships, writ large and sparkly. There are the transcendent portmanteaus, Brangelina, J-Rod, the industry mergers, Kim and Kanye, the legends, Jackie and JFK, the star-crossed lovers, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and the ones who yield whole families of fame, Will and Jada and Willow and Jaden. There are the conscious uncouplings, the cheaters, the fighters, the ones who get back together. And there are Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale, a power pairing of talent, And if you ask anyone on the internet, duplicative hotness, all the more tantalizing for the privacy in which they shroud their relationship and how, yes, just like us, they can seem. They do projects together again and again and again, though they don't do press as a couple. They don't do much press at all. They are rare. They are enigmatic. They are here with us this morning for tea and breakfast in a Toronto cafe. I mean, it's not something we do all the time, but we're trying to go with the flow, Byrne is telling me, cutting her eyes at Canaval, who's settling into the chair next to her. We're generally pretty private. I know, Rose, I know. In the 7 years they've been a couple, they've worked together 5 times and are about to make it 2 more. She was a bright-eyed assistant, and he a sleazy political flunky in the 2014 Annie remake. She, the sadistic daughter of a Russian arms dealer, and he, a terrorist middleman in the 2015 Melissa McCarthy vehicle spy. Recently, they were love-struck beast in Christopher Weeks' short Martha the Monster, and in one episode of the zany Rashida Jones series Angie Tribeca, Canaval's large adult son character becomes smitten with Byrne's Wall Street bigwig Nora Newt. They even played a married couple on the rocks in the indie comedy Adult Beginners. Canaval's character sitting beside Byrne's during an ultrasound appointment, Byrne's character telling Canaval's, "I love you," through a mouthful of toothpaste. A fight, a smooch, a sleepy airing of grievances side by side in bed. Indeed, one would be hard-pressed to think of a romantic partnership with such fruitful on-screen output since Taylor and Burton. "It starts out as a very pragmatic thing," says Canaval. "You have the kids are getting bigger, and you don't want to spend the time apart." Given that much of their joint work was done before the birth of their boys, Rocco, almost 4, and Rafa, 2, it's possible that they also just enjoy working together. Byrne was the one who, when approached for Adult Beginners, suggested Canaval for the role of her character's husband. By happy accident and some subtle machinations on the part of the story's creator and star, Nick Kroll, the part had been written with him in mind. But it's true, the travel is hard. They moved to Brooklyn's Borough Hill neighborhood in 2016, 3 days before Rocco was born, and have spent the intervening years on extended work trips to sets in Atlanta, Los Angeles, and Sydney. Now they've taken up temporary residence in Trinity Bell Woods, which Canaval calls the Brooklyn of Toronto, while Byrne shoots the FX miniseries Mrs. America about Phyllis Schlafly's campaign against the Equal Rights Amendment. She's playing Gloria Steinem. Australia-based productions are particularly attractive to Balmain-born Byrne, whose parents retired to a garlic farm in rugged Tasmania. In 2016, she appeared in the Sydney Theatre Company's Speed the Plough. Next winter, she and Canaval will return to star in A View from the Bridge. "I don't know if you've heard," Canaval says, "but that flight is crazy long and expensive, so we're always trying to find somebody to pay for us to go." Here, Byrne deploys her platonic ideal of a laugh, an infectious ha-ha-ha. He is joking, after all. Mostly. It doesn't hurt that the Arthur Miller play is bucket list material. So, they've worked together, sure. But they've never done anything quite so emotionally probing as the psychological thriller they'll star in this January at Brooklyn Academy of Music, a limited run of writer and director Simon Stone's Medea, which blends the brutal Greek classic with the real-life story of Deborah Green, a Kansas physician who poisoned her husband and killed 2 of their children in a house fire in 1995. "You hear the word Medea, and you've already prepared the audience," says Canaval. "Even if the details are hazy, everybody knows how that story ends. It's a horror story that can read as a revenge tragedy, a cautionary tale of love gone wrong, a proto-feminist war cry, or some amalgam of the three. As soon as he picked up Stone's script, which transmutes Jason and Medea, the mic drop of celebrity couples, into Lucas and Anna, estranged spouses and former colleagues at a contemporary research lab, Canavel says with pleasure, I was filled with this sense of dread. Byrne's apprehension was more existential. We've never done anything like this. I've never done anything like this in my whole life, she says. That role is in the canon of the greatest roles for women ever written. And it's historical. It's mythological. It's also current. Working with my husband, it's exciting, challenging, terrifying. And that's why I'm doing it, you know. Though Byrne wears two bands on her ring finger and calls Canavel her husband, their representative informs me that they are not legally married as of yet. She had a little bit of paranoia around the impact it would have on her psyche, says Stone. Besides the dark aspects of Anna's character, the lead roles push Byrne and Canavel as co-parents themselves toward an uncanny valley. There's a frisson in watching two actors mimic a version of the relationship they actually share. Jane and Henry Fonda in On Golden Pond, Emily Blunt and John Krasinski in A Quiet Place, Will and Jaden Smith in The Pursuit of Happiness, Canavel himself on Nurse Jackie, playing a father to his actual 24-year-old son Jake, whose mother is the award-winning screenwriter Jenny Lumet, Canavel's ex-wife. But for the couple, that tension takes on a particular gravity when the story arc involves infidelity and murdering one's children. It wasn't those sensational aspects that most interested Stone, however. He wanted to explore complex domestic dynamics with a couple who had their own history. Theirs is a case of opposites attracting. Jolo Trulio, Canavel's best friend since high school, describes him as the high-strung rainstorm to Byrne's relaxed cumulus cloud. Their career paths, too, are starkly distinct. Rarely do you find two people who are equally talented and unique and singular voices in their space who work well together and in such a variety of projects, says their former colleague Nick Kroll. Canavel is the New Jersey-born son of a divorced Italian-American chemical plant worker and a Cuban social worker. He spent his adolescence bouncing through the homes of family members in Jersey's Union City, Puerto Rico, and Margate, Florida. After scraping together a high school diploma in the wake of expulsion, he spent years working up to roles on Will and Grace, Vinyl, and Boardwalk Empire. His recent films include I, Tonya, and The Irishman, but he describes feeling like a racehorse pawing at the starting gate between takes, and the theater will always be his first love. He is incredibly masculine and has a very big physical presence, but he's also really effing smart, and there's always a wit and a vulnerability to his characters, says Daniel Radcliffe, his 2018 co-star in The Lifespan of a Fact. Byrne says the immediacy and vulnerability of the theater are a challenge for her, though you wouldn't know it. In the 2014 revival of You Can't Take It With You, her Broadway debut, she elevated her typically flat foil of a character into a hilarious locus of anxiety, raking her hands through her hair until she looked electrified. She never lets you catch her at it, says James Earl Jones of his experience working with Byrne in the play. It was not something she did, it was something she became. Byrne was raised in the suburbs of Sydney, the youngest in a tight-knit quad of children, her parents a statistician and an elementary school administrator, public high school, local university. After a spate of dramas like The Goddess of 1967, in her stunning performance as a blind teenager and victim of sexual assault, she vacillates between naivete and wild catharsis. In her five-season Damages run, She carved out a niche as a straight-faced scene stealer in a slew of popular comedies, Get Him to the Greek, Bridesmaids, The Neighbors films. Glenn Close, Byrne's Damages co-star, says Byrne had something so much more than the kind of acting one was seeing on TV at the time. She says Byrne has great courage and isn't afraid to take risk, but that her most obvious gift is her ability to make people laugh. It was during the Damages years that Byrne and Cannavale got together, introduced by a mutual friend. The chemistry between them is just so remarkable, Close says. Plus, they're both kind of universally loved. In Toronto, they've been spending time at Artscape, a free arts hub and farmers market, and on weekends, the cast of Mrs. America, which includes Cate Blanchett, Uzo Aduba, Tracy Ullman, and Sarah Paulson, can often be found at their house, hanging out. But Madea will bring them back to the place they love most, the Brooklyn of New York. Cannavale misses the long-standing weekly poker games he plays with fellow card sharks John Hamm and Paul Rudd. Byrne misses the galleries, the art shows. They both miss the theater. When Byrne calls Cannavale her biggest champion, in deciding to do Madea, she's very serious, almost reverent. He was like, "We should do this. This is exciting. You know, this is 10 minutes from our house. Ha ha ha. A gallows banter is in effect. Don't kill the kids," says Cannavale in a meditative chant. "Don't kill the kids. Don't kill the kids. Yeah, I'm just going to take some really heavy drugs," says Byrne. "Take the edge off till it's all done." Humor seems to be their love language. When I ask if they've noticed a gendered difference in how they're treated, Byrne says, "Yeah, he's getting hit on all the time." I'm like, "I'm fine. I've never had anything like this situation. I have been objectified all the time," says Cannavale, grinning. It's true. Bobby Cannavale is objectively a sex symbol, is a respectable publication's take on the matter. They revel in a certain script flipping. Cannavale proudly points out their income disparity. "I make half as much as she does," he says. "Down the middle, half. I work too much in the theater, perhaps." Hashtag MeToo has prompted more sober discussions. "I don't know where I fall on the things that I've enjoyed creatively, but are now being canceled because of terrible stories about the director, the actor," says Byrne, who starred in the indefinitely postponed Louis C.K. project, I Love You, Daddy, which premiered just before multiple women accused C.K. of sexual misconduct. But Byrne supported the decision to cancel the film's release and condemned C.K.'s surprise comedy sets in late 2018. She continues what is clearly an ongoing conversation in their house. What to do with the art of unfavorable makers? Michael Jackson, she puts forth, he's in the molecular structure of music. Cannavale chimes in. We're not in opposition with these things, he says. I'm learning. Sometimes I'll say things that she doesn't agree with. I'll go, well, I don't know if I can just cancel all of Woody Allen's movies in my head. And so we might get into an argument about it. Cannavale starred with Blanchett and C.K. in Blue Jasmine, Allen's 2013 twist on A Streetcar Named Desire. But the friction feeds the work. They agree. These discussions are the bedrock that will allow them to attack what Cannavale calls the nuclear material of Madea. One thing Cannavale's certain of, I don't want anybody to tell me I can't tell a story about somebody who is controversial, or I can't portray somebody who is morally conflicted. Those are characters we need to be able to see in order to understand the larger. He slows down, searching for a word. The human condition, Byrne supplies. In a view from the bridge, they'll play married couple Beatrice and Eddie, who becomes infatuated with Beatrice's teenage niece. Following Madea with another fraught marital dynamic will be interesting, I hazard. It'll be distressing, you said? Canavel asked. Byrne, delighted, proclaims the misunderstanding Freudian. One can only imagine the discussions the play will prompt. At 9:48, Canavel says, 10 minutes before we shut the lights off and go to bed. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. John Lewis, the U.S. representative and subject of the documentary John Lewis, Good Trouble, on his hair and his legacy. What is your idea of perfect happiness? When I was growing up on a farm in rural Alabama, I fell in love with raising chickens. They seem truly innocent. Whenever I'm around chickens, I feel happy. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Martin Luther King, Jr., Mohandas Gandhi, and Jesus Christ. They taught us the way of peace, love, and nonviolence. Which living person do you most admire? Barack Obama, because he believed he could be President of the United States, and he succeeded. He was kind, and he tried to set a high standard of leadership. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My tendency to skip meals. What is your greatest extravagance? Buying art, but it makes me happy. What is your favorite journey? Going to my family home in Alabama. I had the best family and have great memories. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I miss my hair. Which living person do you most despise? I despise actions and suffering rather than people. What is your greatest regret? Martin Luther King, Jr. was so young, I thought he would live forever. I regret that I didn't spend more time with him when I had the chance. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My beloved wife, Lillian. She picked up a country boy and helped me build an incredible life. She loved books and art, and they became my passions also. What is your current state of mind? I feel grounded like a tree planted by the river. I'm at home with myself, but I am worried about the future of our country, planet, and democracy. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wouldn't change my family, but I might change our circumstances. It might have been nice to have been born on a different side of the tracks. I really hated picking cotton all day in the hot sun. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Participating in a transformative movement that advocated human dignity and changed America forever. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? The days after my wife passed, we used to talk about everything, all the time. Where would you like to live? Atlanta. What is your favorite occupation? Being a member of Congress is an honor and a privilege. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Loving, compassionate, and determined. Some people think women can only follow, but women can lead. Look at our speaker. She's only the second person in history to ever be elected twice as speaker. We have women judges, governors. Women can be great leaders. Who are your heroes in real life? Barack Obama. How would you like to die? I don't want to die. I don't think I'm going to die, but we all have to die. Since I do, I hope I live on in the hearts and minds of people. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with John Lewis. sorority of stars, Marilyn Monroe, Kim Novak, Ayn Rand, and Rita Moreno all called it home. Carrie Beauchamp uncovers the lost history of L.A.'s women-only Hollywood Studio Club, a safe haven for aspiring celebrities. Opening photo, Rooms of Their Own, a 1950s view of the Hollywood Studio Club courtyard. Residents had to be 18 to 35, and men were prohibited above the first floor. For more than a century in Hollywood, young women have learned in horrendous ways that men in power often consider them goods to be bartered or simply consumed. There is little new about hashtag MeToo, but what is new is that women are shattering their isolation by speaking out and finding strength and community as a result. Yet for nearly 60 years, there was a resident that housed women, 10,000 in all, in a protected and supportive environment. And though few people remember the Hollywood Studio Club, a recounting of its neglected history reveals how little has changed and how powerful female friendships can be. Beginning in the early 1910s, as the movies made Southern California their base of operations, young women flocked to Hollywood, hoping to be a part of it. Fan magazines urged them to stay home. A speech by the world's highest-paid actress, Mary Pickford, warned them to keep away. It didn't work. They flocked west because the movies made the movies look pretty darn good. Films opened a whole new world. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.